Kia ora, I'm your host Graham and welcome back to A Kiwi Perspective, the podcast where we dive deep into issues that matter to everyday New Zealanders and our global audience. In times of war, we hear about weapons, treaties, death tolls. We see maps, military briefings, breaking headlines, but how often do we stop to ask? What kind of mind makes the decisions that lead us to war? Today, we step into the psychological chambers of one of the most enduring and divisive political figures of our time, Benjamin Netanyahu, a man shaped by history, haunted by legacy, and now leading Israel through one of the deadliest wars in a generation. This isn't about taking sides. This is about going inside, inside a mind burdened by survival, power, and the unrelenting weight of war. Segment one, Born into Conflict, A Childhood of Ideology. Benjamin Netanyahu was born in 1949, just a year after the State of Israel declared its independence, a country carved out from the ashes of the Holocaust and deeply contested from the moment of its conception. His birth wasn't just personal, it was political. Every street, every institution, every conversation was charged with the weight of survival, of territory, of memory. The land he grew up on was soaked in both hope and blood. His father, Benzion Netanyahu, was a fierce ideological Zionist and a renowned historian. But Benzion wasn't just academic. He was emotionally militant in his belief that the Jewish people were always one step away from annihilation. To him, the world had abandoned the Jews in their hour of need and might do so again. Benzion's version of history wasn't about cycles of peace and conflict. It was about eternal vigilance. That shaped everything. Imagine growing up in that household. Conversations over dinner weren't idle. They were sharp, focused, intense, often about the Spanish Inquisition, the pogroms, the Holocaust, and Arab nationalism. For Benjamin, strength was not a luxury. It was existential. The idea of compromise wasn't noble. It was dangerous. Even as he moved to the United States during his teen years, attending high school in Pennsylvania, then later studying at MIT and Harvard, Netanyahu never softened. America taught him technique, sure, presentation, strategy, but not empathy, not diplomacy. Those traits, the ones that build bridges, were not part of his core software. In Israel, there's a saying, Ein Brera, there is no choice. Netanyahu absorbed that mindset early. His world was binary, strong or weak, safe or doomed. And then Yonatan, his older brother, brilliant, idealistic, brave, and killed in the 1976 Entebbe raid. That death broke something open in Benjamin. It wasn't just grief, it was canonization. Yonatan became a symbol, not just of what Israel had lost, but of what Netanyahu must now become, the embodiment of heroic sacrifice. So it's not surprising that the young man who returned to Israel from the US didn't become a professor or a philosopher. He became a soldier, then a diplomat, then a prime minister, and every step he took with his father's voice in one ear and his brother's ghost in the other. This is the psychological blueprint of Benjamin Netanyahu, forged in grief, fueled by fear, and fixated on survival. He had no Palestinian friends growing up. He didn't share classrooms, cafes, or futures with Arabs. They were not part of his social fabric. They were framed as part of the threat. And that framing has consequences. When a leader's formative experiences include no humanizing encounters with the other, policies harden, negotiations become performances, peace becomes abstract. Netanyahu's worldview, inherited, experienced, and enforced, was never designed to coexist with compromise. It was designed to endure. He wasn't just born into conflict, he was built by it. Segment two, The Dance with Hamas, A Calculated Enemy. If you only ever read headlines, it would be easy to assume that Benjamin Netanyahu and Hamas are mortal enemies locked in a perpetual struggle, one bent on destruction, the other on defense. And in many ways, that is true. But behind the fiery rhetoric and devastating rocket fire lies a more complex and controversial truth. Netanyahu's governments, across multiple terms, have taken decisions that some argue bolstered Hamas's control over Gaza. One of the most debated moves was allowing Qatari funds to flow into Gaza with Israel's tacit approval. This financial lifeline helped prop up Hamas's administration, allowing them to pay salaries and maintain a grip on power. The justification? Strategy. Divide and rule. By helping Hamas stay in control of Gaza, Netanyahu ensured that the Palestinian leadership remained split, Hamas in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. A divided Palestine, after all, could not speak with one voice, and without unity, there could be no viable peace process. In short, no peace partner, no pressure to make peace. Supporters saw it as tactical brilliance. Critics, including some former Israeli security officials, saw it as playing with fire. One former Shin Bet director warned that this policy was like feeding a beast you claim to be fighting. And yet, the political gamble paid off, at least for a time. With Hamas isolated in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority weakened, Netanyahu could sell the illusion of stability. There were fewer international demands for a final status agreement. He cultivated new diplomatic ties in the Gulf, advanced a security doctrine rooted in deterrence, and framed Israel's situation as managed. But the quiet was always brittle. Then came the October 7th attacks, an eruption of violence that shattered any claims of strategic containment. Hamas's assault exposed not just a failure of intelligence, but a failure of imagination. A failure to see that years of siege, division, and suppression do not extinguish extremism. They often fuel it. The horror of that day, the images, the deaths, the hostages, will remain etched in Israeli memory for decades. And for many, the blame points not just to Hamas, but to the leader who had, however indirectly, helped create the space in which the group flourished. Did Netanyahu, in his effort to weaken the peace process, help empower a force of chaos? This is not to excuse Hamas's actions. They are responsible for their crimes, for terror, for murder, for the ongoing suffering of both Israelis and Palestinians. But politics is not only judged by intentions, it is judged by consequences. And here the consequences are devastating, not only in loss of life, but in the moral erosion of a strategy that treats civilian suffering as a tolerable price for political expediency. This episode of Israeli policy should be a case study for the world, how attempting to engineer a weak enemy can backfire catastrophically, how the politics of short-term survival can sabotage long-term peace, and how leadership rooted in manipulation rather than resolution ultimately fails the people it claims to protect. Because enemies do not stay in their boxes. They adapt, they radicalize, they remember. And when war erupts, it is never confined to one side of the border. The Israeli public, once deferential to Netanyahu's security credentials, erupted in protest. The war sparked one of the deepest crises of trust in his tenure. Many, including families of hostages, demanded answers, not just action. Because in the calculus of war and politics, the most dangerous thing a leader can do is believe he's too clever to be burned by the fire he helped ignite. Segment 3, Jewish ethics and the price of power. In the public imagination, religion and politics are often kept in separate compartments. But in Israel, and particularly in the life of Benjamin Netanyahu, those compartments constantly collapse into one another. Though Netanyahu presents himself as a secular leader, a pragmatist, a technocrat of security and strategy. He knows the emotional resonance of religious symbolism. He may not wear the kippah daily or quote the Torah in every speech, but when he invokes faith, it is deliberate, strategic, powerful. His encounter with the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the 1980s has become almost mythical in Israeli political lore. The Rebbe told him, "You will go to the United Nations. Remember, you are not just a man, you are a representative of the Jewish people. Light a candle for truth." It's a moment Netanyahu has recalled often, especially when positioning himself as Israel's spokesperson to the world. But herein lies a contradiction, because Judaism, at its ethical core, holds life sacred. The Talmud says, "Whoever saves a single life is considered to have saved the whole world." That's not metaphor. It's a guiding light in Jewish law, a moral compass that overrides nearly all other commandments. This principle is called pikuach nefesh, the preservation of life above all. And yet, under Netanyahu's leadership, many of Israel's actions in Gaza, the bombings, the blockades, the sieges, seem to strain, if not break, that moral thread. Whole apartment blocks reduced to ash, ambulances blocked, journalists killed, children, hundreds of them, dead. The justification? Israel's right to self-defense, a right enshrined in international law, a right no reasonable person denies. But defense has limits. It must be proportional, measured, moral. And this is where Netanyahu's policies draw fire, not just from foreign critics, but from within Israel itself. Leading rabbis, former IDF commanders, Israeli journalists, even Holocaust survivors have questioned whether his approach reflects the values that Judaism is supposed to uphold. For many Jews around the world, especially in the diaspora, this is deeply personal. Judaism is not just an identity, it's an ethical legacy, one forged in suffering, yes, but also in compassion. The Jews know what it means to be stateless, to be vilified, to be dehumanized. That historical memory carries with it a responsibility not to become what we once feared. And yet in Gaza, that moral inheritance feels frayed. This is not about moral equivalence. It is not to say that Hamas and Israel are the same. They are not. Hamas targets civilians intentionally. It glorifies martyrdom and teaches hate. But what sets a democratic state apart is not its enemy, it is its standards. And when a nation built in response to genocide rains missiles on refugee camps, it must ask, not just is this legal, but is this right? Netanyahu, when pressed, often responds with precision, with metrics, with timelines. He says, we gave warnings, we used surgical strikes, we did what we had to do. But moral leadership isn't measured in bullet points. It's measured in lives spared, in empathy shown, in dignity preserved. A truly Jewish state, grounded in Jewish ethics, must stand for more than survival. It must also stand for justice. Because when Pikuach Nefesh becomes conditional, when the sanctity of life is reserved for only one people, the moral high ground begins to crumble. The tragedy of Netanyahu's leadership is not that he lacks intelligence or courage, it's that he often confuses power with righteousness. And in doing so, he risks severing Israel from the very ethical roots that gave it legitimacy in the first place. Segment 4, the politics of perpetual survival. In the modern history of Israel, no leader has been more politically durable or polarizing than Benjamin Netanyahu. Over the course of more than 15 years in power across multiple terms, he has become synonymous with the very concept of Israeli security. But what exactly has Netanyahu been securing, and at what cost? He has weathered more political scandals than most democracies would tolerate, from corruption investigations to failed coalition negotiations, and yet each time he emerges, sometimes weakened, sometimes emboldened, but always still standing. This ability to outlast his rivals has earned him the nickname the Magician. But behind the political showmanship is a darker truth. Netanyahu's politics are built not on progress, but on perpetual crisis. To survive, he must keep the electorate in a state of heightened alert, and nothing galvanizes a nation like war. During his recent push to overhaul Israel's judiciary, a deeply controversial move seen by many as an attempt to shield himself from prosecution, hundreds of thousands of Israelis protested in the streets. His popularity was plunging. International confidence in his leadership was waning. Then came war. For some, the timing was eerily convenient. It is not to say that Netanyahu orchestrated the violence, but many Israelis, including former generals and intelligence officials, now question whether his government's policies, particularly toward Gaza, allowed the situation to escalate unchecked. Critics argue that Netanyahu needs conflict, that his political identity is so intertwined with crisis that without one, his leadership lacks purpose. This is not unique to him. Many leaders have used conflict to rally support, to stoke nationalism, to distract from domestic failures. But in Netanyahu's case, the pattern is stark. Conflict, survival, victory, repeat. It is a cycle that has worked until now. But with public trust eroding and the costs of war mounting, that cycle is beginning to fracture. In a democracy, power is supposed to be checked by institutions, not preserved through fear. And yet, Netanyahu's greatest skill may be convincing Israelis that only he can keep them safe, that without him, the gates will fall. But here's the paradox. The more he tightens control, the more volatile the region becomes. The more wars he fights, the less peace seems possible. Because leadership driven by survival rather than vision always demands a new enemy. And when the enemies run out, the spotlight inevitably turns inward. Segment 5, the demons within, leadership as projection. Beneath the strategies, the speeches, the headlines, there is a man. And like all leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu is not immune to the invisible forces that shape human behavior: fear, grief, ambition, and unresolved legacy. In psychological terms, leadership is not only about public acts, it is also deeply shaped by personal narratives. And Netanyahu's story is full of defining moments, heavy burdens, and symbolic weight. His father, Benzion, looms large in his psyche. Benzion was a historian obsessed with Jewish survival, especially the idea that appeasement had led to catastrophe in the 20th century. He believed Jews would always be targets, that they could never, ever let their guard down. Growing up under that kind of doctrine doesn't leave you. It becomes a framework, a filter through which every threat is magnified and every opponent viewed with suspicion. And then, of course, there's Yonatan, the brother who died in battle and became a national hero. Netanyahu has often said he draws strength from his brother's legacy, but legacies can also become prisons. A leader constantly measuring himself against the ideal of heroic sacrifice may come to believe that only through conflict can greatness be achieved. So we ask, are Netanyahu's decisions, his hardline stances, his distrust of peace processes entirely political, or are they also emotional? Does he project the anxieties of his upbringing onto the geopolitical stage? This isn't armchair psychology. This is about understanding the deep imprint of trauma and legacy on leadership. A person who sees enemies everywhere may not be paranoid. They may just be replaying a script written long ago, a script of loss, of siege, of eternal vigilance. The trouble is, when a national leader lives by that script, it becomes national policy. Foreign relations are shaped not just by data or strategy, but by deeply internalized fears. The Gaza war, then, is not just about territory or terrorism. It is also about the internal landscape of a man who has never stopped being at war, with memory, with legacy, with the shadows of his past. Because when demons are left unconfronted, they do not disappear. They project outward. They shape how a leader sees the world and how the world must react. Netanyahu has mastered the art of political survival, but true leadership isn't just about surviving the enemy. It's about knowing when the enemy is within. Segment 6, A Kiwi. Reflection, what leadership could be. From the quiet shores of Aotearoa, we watch these global storms unfold, sometimes in disbelief, often with a quiet sadness. We're a small country, tucked at the edge of the world, but our voice, our perspective, still matters. Here in New Zealand, we know something about conflict, about land and rights and identity. We've had our own reckonings, the Treaty of Waitangi, the long road to honouring it, the pain of injustice and the healing of recognition. And from that experience, we've learned that leadership is not just about force. It's about listening, understanding, knowing when to step back and when to reach out. In Netanyahu, we see a leader who has defined himself through resistance, through strength, through the refusal to yield. But leadership can also be measured in a very different currency: humility, compassion, imagination. New Zealand is not perfect. No country is. But we try to lead by principle, not by fear. We believe in dialogue, in community, in the power of shared humanity. So what would it mean, truly, for a leader like Netanyahu to change course? To recognize that strength can look like mercy, that courage can look like compromise, that legacy can be rewritten, not through domination, but through peace. It's not naive to hope for that. It's necessary. Because the world is watching, not just the missiles or the military briefings, but how leaders respond to crisis, with cruelty or with conscience. And in that space, Aotearoa offers a gentle challenge. What if leadership meant more than victory? What if it meant leaving behind a world safer? Not because you silenced your enemies, but because you no longer needed them. Closing scene, the weight of war. Benjamin Netanyahu is not just a politician. He is a symbol, a mirror of a nation's fears, its pride, its past traumas, and its hopes. His story is not Israel's story, but it reflects a particular chapter, one written in the language of defense, fear, survival, and control. And now, as this latest war continues to scar both Israeli and Palestinian lives, we are left with a lingering question, not just about Netanyahu, but about all of us. What kind of leadership do we want to follow into the future? A leadership of entrenchment, of fortress mentalities, of zero-sum equations, or a leadership that dares to risk peace, even when it's politically costly, even when it's personally vulnerable? The weight of war does not fall evenly. It falls hardest on those with the least power, on families in Gaza who have lost everything, on Israeli communities living in fear of the next rocket, on children who inherit wounds they never caused. This episode has not aimed to pass judgment. It has aimed to understand, to look beyond the tactics and into the psychology, to ask what drives a man who has become both steward and shadow of his people's fears, and to wonder what could happen if he and we chose a different path. Aotearoa teaches us that peace is not the absence of struggle. It is the result of relentless, courageous dialogue. It takes time, it takes humility, it takes imagination. And perhaps that is the most urgent demand of our age, to imagine peace, not as weakness, but as wisdom. Thank you for listening. Wherever you are in the world, may you carry forward the questions we've asked here. May you speak them aloud, and may you demand better, not just from leaders, but from each other. Ka kite ano, and take care.